the headlines, Russia says U.S.'s plan to train Ukrainian troops to use Patriot missile systems confirms Washington's de facto participation in the Ukraine war. Brazilian authorities issue arrest warrants for two former senior officials as they seek to punish a mob that stormed government buildings over the weekend. And also, Peru's Attorney General launches a preliminary investigation against President Boluarte on charges of genocide, homicide, and serious injuries. Our top story for this half hour, the United States says it plans to begin training Ukrainian forces at a military base in Oklahoma on how to use and maintain Patriot missile systems.
I can confirm that training for Ukrainian forces on the Patriot air defense system will begin as soon as next week at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Russian ambassador to Washington has reacted to the U.S.'s decision. Anatoly Antonov says the move is another proof of the U.S.'s de facto participation in the conflict. Antonov added that Washington's goal is to inflict as much damage as possible on Russia on the battlefield. This is yet another sign of tension between Russia and the West. On Tuesday, the Secretary of Russia's Security Council and a close aide to President Vladimir Putin said his country is now fighting NATO in Ukraine. Nikolai Patrushev said the events in Ukraine are not a clash between Moscow and Kiev, but a military confrontation between Russia and NATO. Since the beginning of the war in February, Western countries have been supplying weapons and military equipment to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. Our correspondent in Crimea says he believes the U.S.-led NATO military alliance is pursuing long-term policies for the war in Ukraine.
This is another charge of weapons that the United States has promised to Ukraine. It's interesting that they say it'll take several months to train these soldiers in these Patriot systems, an indication that NATO is in this war, is pursuing their policies for the long term. Indeed, there's a feeling here amongst Russian people that they are resigned to the likelihood that this conflict will go on for years. This conflict, of course, has three elements. It's first of all a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists who took power in 2014 and its culturally Russian-speaking Russian population. It's also an attempt by Russia to, as it sees it, secure its geostrategic security, particularly Crimea. And then it's also an attempt by NATO countries to damage Russian power. And that's very much what we're seeing here with the supply of these weapons. That's understood in policy circles, but it's a debate that's not really allowed in mainstream discourse.
A Supreme Court judge in Brazil has ordered the arrest of two former senior officials in connection with recent storming of key public buildings by supporters of ex-president Jair Bolsonaro. Judge Alexandre de Moraes issued the arrest warrant for Anderson Torres, who served as Bolsonaro's justice minister and lately served as security chief in the capital. The judge calls potentially criminal Torres's failure to act as mobs overran Congress, the apex court, and the presidential palace over the weekend. Reports say former military police chief Fabio Augusto has also been detained as part of a probe running under Moraes. Both officials were removed from their jobs after rioting and vandalism in the capital, Brasilia. At least 1,500 people have been detained and are being questioned. Protests came days after Lula da Silva was sworn in as president following one of the most divisive elections in Brazil's history. Earlier, we asked podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnamowari if she sees any similarity between the violence in Brazil and the 2021 riots in the U.S.
Superficially, yes. As in, superficially, they stormed the Congress, the Supreme Court of Brazil and also the presidential palace, and there's a lot of aesthetics. But I see it as far more dangerous, just because we know that in what they did in Congress in 2021 was not likely to result in any change of power. But here we saw that the police and many members of the federal police actively aided the rioters. And also the governor of Brasilia, Mr. Rocha, was sacked recently because he participated in organizing these riots. So while superficially they look similar, I think this, even Lula agrees, the situation in Brazil is far more dangerous than anything that could have happened in the U.S.
And Peru is launching a preliminary investigation into President Dina Boluarte on charges of genocide, homicide, and serious injuries. The country's attorney general said Prime Minister Alberto Otaola and the defense and interior ministers will also be investigated. This shortly after the prime minister announced a three-day nighttime curfew in the southern region of Puno, running from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. local time. That is, on Monday, 18 people, including one police officer, were killed in clashes between police and demonstrators. The death toll in a month of protests against the ouster of President Pedro Castillo has risen to 40. The government has defended the actions of security forces, claiming the protests amount to a, quote, organized coup attempt. Protesters want early elections, resignation of the new president, and the closure of Congress. They also want the ousted president released. Castillo was arrested after being removed from office in December. After dodging questions for several days, the U.S. president has finally spoken about classified documents found at his former office. Joe Biden claims he didn't know about those files and was taken by surprise.
I was briefed about this discovery and surprised to learn that there were any government records that were taken there to that office. But I don't know what's in the documents. My lawyers have not suggested I ask what documents they were, and we're cooperating fully with the review, and which I hope will be finished soon, and there'll be more detail at that time.
Biden's attorneys discovered fewer than a dozen classified records in a locked closet at the Penn Biden Center think tank based at the University of Pennsylvania. Biden periodically used the space from mid-2017 until the start of his 2020 presidential campaign, but the issue has sparked a political wrangling in the U.S., with former President Donald Trump asking the FBI when it's going to, quote, raid the many homes of Biden. The FBI stormed Trump's house in Florida last year in search of classified documents he was keeping, despite repeated calls by the National Archives to turn them over. U.S. House Republicans have already voted to create a new committee to investigate what they call Biden's weaponization of the federal government. And more news from the U.S. Authorities in the state of California have issued evacuation orders for tens of thousands of more residents as the latest Pacific storm unleashes severe weather on the country's west coast. Californians were threatened by severe weather on Tuesday after torrential downpours and high winds knocked out electricity and plunged thousands of homes and businesses into darkness. The state has been ravaged by a barrage of storms recently that have left at least 17 people dead. Floods and mudslides also caused the closure of key highways, toppled trees, and swept away vehicles. The California governor says the storm is expected to continue until January 18th. The National Weather Service has predicted a fresh storm in Northern California with a lot of snow in mountainous areas on Wednesday. Top American companies are now laying off employees at levels not seen since the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. The World Bank now forecasts that the U.S. will just barely avoid recession this year, meaning the job cuts may only be starting. Rami Mazzari has more in the story from Chicago.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street to the cryptocurrency sector, but also from Amazon to McDonald's, seemingly every day sees a new announcement of thousands of layoffs. Strikes to preserve jobs, once rarely seen and rarely reported on, are increasing nationwide, But it's hard to precisely say how bad unemployment will get because there is increasing admission that the official jobless statistics are willfully inaccurate. Full-time job offers have plunged, while part-time work, which pays less and offers few benefits like health care, have soared. But the increase in part-time work continues to count towards full employment to give the United States an official unemployment rate of 3.5%.
The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, according to them, if you are a discouraged worker, if you stop looking for work, you no longer count for the unemployment data. If you are a gig worker, you also don't count in the unemployment data. So already that lets you know that the data is skewed.
Many believe that when the nation's top bankers know that their sustained hike in interest rates are guaranteed to produce layoffs and recession, then it's clear that fiscal policy isn't aimed at protecting the lower and middle classes. The near certainty of high unemployment long term caused a small group of progressives in Congress to accuse the Fed of having, quote, an apparent disregard for the livelihoods of millions of working Americans. President Joe Biden has allowed the pandemic era's successful and unprecedented monetary redistribution policies to lapse, throwing many households and children back into poverty amid the inflation-related instability.
Prior to the pandemic, 140 million people were at the poverty line or below, and all the policies such as the child tax credit, which was proven to take children out of poverty, was done away with, right? If it's been proven to actually, you know, mitigate child poverty, why was it eradicated, right? So, you know, the economy, you know, it's like the same thing in any type of class society, right? There's always two sides, for the rich and for the rest of us.
The Washington-based lender, the World Bank, just slashed their growth outlook for the global economy by half, predicted that one-third of the world will fall into recession this year, and said the United States will have a growth rate of just 0.5%. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The UK is bracing itself for another wave of public sector strikes after talks between unions and the government over pay rises and better working conditions fell through. As Said Puraza reports, the UK government is now trying to make it harder to strike rather than offering concessions to settle the dispute.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low.
Brexit has destroyed investment. It's led to us being a less attractive place for foreign direct investment as well. So, unfortunately, We've got a lot of self-inflicted wounds, plus Ukraine, plus, you know, fairly incompetent government.
But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences.
Once you start sacking people, people are more likely to even go on strike together. I mean, ultimately, this is so much against the trade union movement, they risk a national strike over it because trade unions will gang together to make sure that they have an impact and stop this kind of legislation.
Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Purizep, London.
A man wielding a knife has injured several people at a busy train station in the French capital, Paris. Police say they shot and wounded the suspect before arresting him at Gare du Nord train station. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin, on his Twitter post, has thanked the police for their courageous and effective response, saying the attacker was neutralized. The attacker's motive and his identity were not immediately clear. According to the French media, the incident caused major delays to trains. Gare du Nord is one of the busiest train stations in Europe and a major link between Paris, London, and Northern Europe. France remains on a state of heightened security alert since a spate of deadly attacks in 2015. And police in Germany have dragged away activists staging a sit-in protest against the expansion of a brown coal mine. Police also dismantled barricades set up in a public display of anger in the abandoned village of Lüttersarath in North Rhine-Westphalia region. Activists had formed human chains and occupied deserted buildings in the village, whose land and houses now belong to energy firm RWE. The company runs a coal mine in the village and plans to expand it. The German government's climate policy has been under fire. Environmentalists say the government has not done enough about its climate policy at a time of energy crisis in Europe. The war in Ukraine has forced Germany to extend the lifespan of nuclear power stations after Russia cut gas deliveries to Europe.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A new survey has found that 1 in 4 Europeans have trouble heating their home. According to this survey, more than a quarter of Europeans are experiencing problems heating their homes and paying debts for housing and utilities. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, more than a quarter of Europeans are experiencing problems heating their homes and paying debts for housing and utilities. The Hungarian media reported recently, citing a survey by the Sedovec think tank. According to the survey, dubbed Europroject, 26% of the sample, representing roughly 100 million people, are unable to properly heat their homes. Greeks appear to be the worst affected, with 56% of the population facing difficulties with heating. In Portugal and France, 34% of residents describe the same problems. Finland, Hungary, Austria, and Denmark were the least affected, with less than 15% of residents admitting to difficulties. Every fourth respondent in the survey said they were unable to pay their heating bill at least once during the past year. That figure was also the highest in Greece, with 51% of the population affected, followed by Cyprus with 37%, Ireland and Bulgaria with 35% each. The respondents blamed inflation for their problems, as rising prices on everything from energy to food impact their ability to pay bills. According to the survey, heating bills have become far less affordable than in 2021. The authors noted that in 2021, based on data from Europe's official statistics agency Eurostat, only 6.9% of European households, some 29.9 million people, were unable to adequately heat their homes, and 6.4% struggled with paying bills. The survey was conducted among 38,000 randomly selected European adults between October 13th and December 7th, 2022. The research covered the EU, UK, Norway, Switzerland, Moldova, Albania, Kosovo, North Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Meanwhile, Guardian reported more than 700,000 people in England and Wales are living in homes without central heating this winter, one in 10 of whom are elderly and ill, according to figures that lay bare the plight of the most vulnerable. The new official data highlights the extreme end of the conditions being suffered by those who live in 4-meter homes. The government rates as non-decent for failing to meet basic standards. With the country enduring its chilliest month, charities lobbying for the rights of elderly people have warned that cold homes could cause 10,000 unnecessary deaths this winter. A government spokesperson, when approached for comment, described the lack of central heating in homes as completely unacceptable, but ministers stand accused of failing those living in the worst conditions. Office for National Statistics ONS analysis based on the 2021 census shows that 699,500 people live in a home without central heating in England. London has the largest number of households without central heating, 76,190, followed by the rest of Southeast, 49,875, the Southwest, 42,550, and the Northwest, 47,710. There are a further 15,496 homes in Wales without central heating. Confirmed figures are due to be released from 2021 census recently. The ONS further reports that among those living without central heating in England, 68,100 are aged 65 and over with long-term health conditions. A central heating system provides warmth to a number of spaces within a building from one main source of heat, typically a gas boiler in the UK. Holly Holder, the Deputy Director for Homes at the Centre for Ageing Better, said the number of homes without central heating in England is truly shocking. We have among the worst and least efficient homes in Western Europe, and often it is older people who have to reside in these subpar properties. The life and death and implications of this are really being seen now as we enter the bracing cold of midwinter at the height of a cost of living crisis, she added. The consequences of such a poor standard of housing are deadly. Cold homes kill. The UK has a high excess winter mortality, far greater than in much colder European countries, such as Norway, where properties are better insulated. Rishi Sunak is already under fire for his U-turn on plans for local compulsory house building targets that could raise the standards of the country's housing stock. The policy was dropped after pressure from Tory backbench MPs. One in five, 21.5% of excess deaths in England are related to cold homes, with the UK as a whole said to have among the oldest and poorest quality housing stock in Western Europe. Recently published data from the English Housing Survey has highlighted the poor state of the country's private rental sector, in particular, with 23% of private rentals failing to meet the decent homes standard in 2021 to 2022. That compares with just 13% of the owner-occupied homes and 10% of social housing. James Anderson, the founder of the Disability and Elderly Plumbing and Heating Emergency Repair, a community initiative in the northwest of England for those unable to fix their homes, said he regularly came across houses without central heating. The plumbing and heating engineer recently launched a funding appeal for an elderly woman in Houghton, Liverpool, who was relying on a small electric heater to keep her warm. Anderson warned she was unlikely to survive the winter in her dilapidated and freezing terrace home. Irene has had to get used to this, but she shouldn't have to. She nearly cried when we told her we were going to help her out, he said. Matt Copeland, the head of policy at the Fuel Party charity National Energy Action, said there had been a failure to help the poorest households retrofit their homes, leaving them reliant on expensive and inefficient electric heaters in many cases. Households without central heating are some of the worst affected by the energy crisis and are twice as likely to be fuel poor than households who do have centrally heated homes, he said. They're also significantly more likely to live in the least energy efficient properties. This winter, with prices high and temperatures dropping, those homes will find it prohibitively expensive to stay warm at home. It is imperative that fuel poor households that are off the gas grid are prioritized for any future target support. A government spokesperson said they were currently consulting over the powers of the regulator of social housing to tackle non-decent homes and that ministers were introducing a decent homes standard for the private rented sector. She added, it is completely unacceptable that families are having to live in homes without heating and we are acting to ensure people can stay warm this winter. This includes £1,200 to help pay their bills. The decent homes standard requires all social homes to have an efficient form of heating, such as central heating, and we will also introduce this to privately rented homes to help those who use heating oil and fuel other than gas to warm their homes. We have increased the alternative fuel payment to £200 and are committed to delivering this to customers as soon as possible.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
There's another case of U.S. killing civilians. A U.S. drone strike killed 10 civilians in Afghanistan back in August of 2021. Worse yet, U.S. military officials knew that this drone strike had killed Afghan civilians, including children, but lied about it. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. drone campaign has resulted in so many deaths, the recurrence, the faulty intel, and how the U.S. believes lying about it makes them exempt from prosecution. We'll also look at how the decision to go to war in the first place is the reason for so many deaths in the first place. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Judith Bellow, peace and justice activist, joins us from Rochester. Also joining us is Fra Hughes, who's a journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. I'd like to welcome you both. Judith Bellow, I'll first start with you, taking a look at the incident itself. In case we need a refresher here, it's 10 members of the same family. It included 7 children. You have the youngest victims, who were 2-year-old girls. They were targeted because you had the father carrying water containers that were mistaken for explosives. How do you explain the kind of intel that went into concluding that this happened? I'm sure there were a lot of reasons, but basically the fact that you have the U.S. that's supposed to have state-of-the-art intel accessibility in one form or another, and yet for this incident to have happened?
Well, I feel that there is no explanation that would satisfy me. I believe that the explanations given by the U.S. government are inadequate to this purpose. This is, however, a common occurrence with drones, that they've been tracking this guy. When they finally launched that drone, they had been tracking the guy for days. So in that amount of time, they should have been able to see that his course was not the course of someone who was a member of Al-Qaeda. And beyond that, they, if they had looked at the listings in our own government, they would have seen that he was an employee of one of our government agencies, a charity that's registered with the government, and they would have been able to see that he was on his normal route. So in my opinion, this is, you can't call what went into this strike intelligence. It was, a kind of hysterical reaction to the events the day before and to the fact that the entire withdrawal of the U.S. from Afghanistan Indeed. Was done in a disordered and chaotic way, which did not allow the people involved, including the Americans who were working to Sure. facilitate this, to be able to calmly and reasonably do their work.
Well, this is what I'm trying to get at over here, and please help me out, Frahi, is because I'm trying to understand how you can be in a position of a military stature of one type of concentration or another that contributes to you making life-taking decisions and looking at the situation, and maybe I'm wrong in looking at it this way, because it's elementary what I'm asking, is that you take a look at this car and you have these containers that are mistaken for explosives. How do you go from that to that type of mistake, and then to ordering the killing, and for that to be targeted, where they, well, based on the U.S. Announcement, they called it a defensive airstrike, a defensive one, targeting a suspected ISIS-K suicide bomber who posed an imminent threat to the airport. This happened after, of course, the airport was targeted and you had some U.S. soldiers that were killed. But just the logic that goes into that, from the container part to explosive devices, and then for them, order to be given.
Well, you could see it as a simple case of shoot first and ask questions later. One of the articles that I was reading said that there was a second drone possibly being flown by the CIA. And the very fact that the drone is in the air, the very fact that they're following the vehicle, surely with eyes on, they must have been able to see that they were children inside the vehicle. I think it's possible it was an overreaction.
So they would know that, you think? Military. You're saying that they would know that there were children inside the vehicle?
Well, I'm assuming that the very fact that they can see the water canisters, did we all see video of the water canisters being actually fitted onto the vehicle at some stage before it left the family compound? So, you know, if they were following it from the very start, I am assuming, and maybe wrongly, that they saw children get into the vehicle, but had decided that it posed too much of a risk for the American forces at the airbase and decided just to take it out. It proves again the dehumanization of people who are non-Anglo-Saxon white people living in West Asia, Latin America, and on the mainland African continent, that their lives have no value if there's a threat, a perceived threat against Western imperialist designs within the region and the personnel that carry that out. They're just going to kill people first. I mean, it's not new. We've seen it all before, and it's not just the Americans. If you look at the Mossad's targeting of Hamas leaders in Gaza, they think nothing of targeting their military target along with anyone who accompanies that person, which could be a military command structure, could be their family. We have seen drone attacks all over the likes of Sudan, where they have carried out these extrajudicial assassinations and murdered people to include their families. We've seen attacks on Afghan wedding parties where people were firing kind of small arms in the air to celebrate the weddings. And on more than three or four occasions, Americans and Afghan soldiers called in airstrikes and murdered those people. So there's nothing new in this. And, you know, when you look at what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians not connected to the Japanese military in any sense, wiped out by America with the atom bomb. And you actually had, I mean, you could claim that collateral damage can be used as a governmental policy, because Winston Churchill directed Bomber Harris to bomb Dresden between the 13th and the 15th of, I think it was February 1945. And there were 600,000 people in the city, and there were hundreds of thousands of more refugees fleeing from the front line. And they deliberately targeted that town, and the claims between 25,000 and 250,000 civilians were murdered. Winston Churchill wanted German cities bombed to create civilian casualties to overrun the railway structure and the road structure in Germany in order to prevent the Wehrmacht or whatever carrying on the war. So it's possibly government policy, but it's definitely a government priority to kill people when it suits them without any cause or being held to account.
Yeah, this is government policy, and the fact that it's nothing new in it, I'd like to put those two together and ask you, Judith Bello, with the concentration or the focus of my question being on the way that the U.S. handles these situations, because it's not something that's actually highlighted that often. When you have, after the strike that happened in August of 2022, you have an Army Major General that comes out and says, we are aware of reports of civilian casualties. This one being the Pentagon spokesman, John Kirby, the U.S. works hard to avoid civilian casualties. We're investigating this. And then coming out to the fact that you have the December 13 announcement coming after they said we're going to investigate it, saying no U.S. troops will be punished for deadly Kabul strike. Pentagon chief decides. okay? And this is while we are coming to the topic of our program, which shows that the military officials and the higher-ups were aware that civilians had been killed in this incident. What does that show in terms of the way that the U.S. kept it from disclosing it, not being coherent about it, and then, of course, now it's been revealed that they were aware of it?
Yes, well, this is standard procedure. They saw that they had killed all these civilians, and they knew it would cause people to be upset. So they created, they not only denied it, but they created a smokescreen of quasi-denial so that people would not, attack them. People would not be angry with them for what they did. And as far as no servicemen being punished for it, I think this is standard American policy. I mean, the United States didn't join the International Criminal Court because if they joined, then Americans would be subject to its jurisdiction. So the everywhere the United States has a base, they have a special set of rules where the host country will not prosecute any Americans for any crime. And this has been a horrific problem in Japan over the long years because Americans, being culturally, I think, racist, have committed horrific crimes in Japan, Americans living on the base. And I wouldn't say that about all soldiers or all Americans there because I know actually some people that are within their own understanding, honorable, who are soldiers working on these bases or have been. But there is, because there's no consequences, I mean, the consequence for a soldier who commits a crime in Japan against a civilian right now is that they get sent home, basically. That's it. If they kill somebody, if they rape a woman, whatever, they get sent home. And so when you look at Afghanistan and all this chaos, of course, they're not going to accuse any soldiers of any crimes, and they're not going to convict any soldiers of any crimes. And what's happening there, what happened there at that moment was really, an unacceptable breach by the management in the entire procedure of evacuating U.S. soldiers from there. They didn't bring the people who had helped us. As you can see, they didn't care about this guy who had for years been working as an assistant to an American NGO.
Sure.
They were completely, because nobody exists in the world except the Americans. Everyone else is on
a
different plane.
Yeah, there's a couple problems with a couple issues that you raised there, and the most important one, Frahi, is that I'd like to ask you, which, and I appreciate Judith Miller for pointing that out, is the fact that you have the U.S. being the number one country in the world with the most bases, as far as we know, from 600 to 700 or even more, I'm not too sure. And the fact that you have its forces that come under this, what they want and what they have said is their U.S. legal jurisdiction, which means that they're immune from, for example, courts, and that any investigations of any wrongdoing by the forces will usually end up with them not being prosecuted. That's a problem, isn't it? I mean, I'm not too sure why countries that U.S. has military bases on would agree to that. Why shouldn't this be revised, or why shouldn't there be something that really prevents this immunity? Because then the U.S. soldiers feel like they can... I'm not too sure. Go ahead, like it's the Wild Wild West.
Yes, I believe there are over 800 American bases throughout the globe. I think you could say that if you create a kind of consensus of immunity, then what you will breed is a form of disregard for human life, a feeling that people are above and beyond the law. We can see it perhaps every day if we just look at what's happening in the occupied territories of the West Bank. You know, the Israelis and the apartheid illegal occupation is murdering Palestinians at will. And the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves under any and all circumstances, using any and all means to resist this foreign occupation. So, you know, the foreign occupation of the West Bank, foreign occupation of Iraq, the foreign occupation of Afghanistan, and several other countries in the region. It just proves that when you create a sense of immunity, that then people can, you're potentially creating monsters who feel that they can go out and do whatever it is they want with absolutely no recourse to the courts for the victims and absolutely no accountability for the perpetrators. I think one other way potentially to look at this is that if you didn't have that culture, if you had a culture of morality within the armed services, if you had a cultural of accountability within the armed services, some of the people who fire these, who kind of use these drones and maybe see civilians in the area, make to say, well, I'm not going to fire that because I could be subject to war crimes commission. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. The fact that I know there was an incident in Britain recently, it's only 2 or 3 years ago, mm-hmm. where someone connected with the American Airbase, I think they were drink driving, and run over a young British national, I believe, he was either on the road or on a motorcycle. That person fled back to America, and America does not have a reciprocal extradition policy with Britain. So America can't ask for Britain to extradite its citizens for crimes committed in America if those people have returned to Britain, but not vice versa. So, you know, America does believe it's above international law, which is obvious by its actions and by its war crimes, sure. and by its war atrocities. And the individuals within that feel that they can do whatever they want because, as everyone agrees, there's no accountability.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, you know, when you take a look at the astronomical figure, Judith Bellow, that the U.S. Actually spends on, they call it defense. It's really offense, but it's their budget, military budget of, I think it's a record. It reached $1 trillion, maybe a little bit more if you put it all together, and if you add Ukraine in there. So you would think that they have the state-of-the-art, it's said the U.S. has state-of-the-art military hardware. So you go from the Afghanistan war, and I'm going to fast forward from there to, not fast forward, but to then cross on over to the war in Syria and mention one particular incident where there was, and this was revealed in the Afghan papers, where this incident happened in Syria where the U.S. Special Operations believed that they were targeting Daesh terrorist staging areas in the northern part of the country. They reported that 85 fighters were killed, but then when all the dust settled, more than 120 villagers were killed. I mean, this is just unbelievable. This is part of the history's dustbin at this point. But how is it that they're not learning from their mistakes, from their wars, from all these offensive operations where you have this, again, I picked this out. This happened in July of 2016. Why are they not learning from it?
Okay. I think they're not learning from it because the brass, the officials, do not consider these mistakes consequential. And because the guys at the low end who commit them want to cover up for themselves. They don't want people to know that they would do such a thing. And Vietnam is the last war that I was alive for, and this has been going on since Vietnam. It's been going on in every war the U.S. fights. Normally, as with Syria and Afghanistan, the U.S. is prosecuting quote-unquote wars. A war should be between two equal opposing parties. not a big guy hammering someone with less resources. And this is true of drones. Again, a drone war is, you know, a way to prosecute a war without being at risk yourself. And so I belong to an organization called Ban Killer Drones and another local organization that around the local drone base, because these weapons are an invitation to commit atrocities and shrug them off. Because the feeds on a drone are not that accurate. The video feeds, especially if the drone is flying pretty high, are very inaccurate. And so the people reading the feed and making decisions based on it do not have a lot of information. It's not like there was a TV show and they showed a drone feed and it was like looking like a TV camera or something. You could see every detail. That's not how it is. And so these guys become accustomed to operating in an environment where they don't clearly see what's going on. And so mistakes, of course, are going to happen. Mm-hmm. And there are aggressive people who might do it on purpose. But I think in many cases, it really is just that there's not a lot. They know they're not going to be held responsible. And their information isn't really clear. And there are so many drone pilots in this country right now suffering from PTSD from these wars because the decisions to prosecute them are wrong. They are decisions to send a military force against a civilian population that does not have an equal military force to defend itself. So these are decisions made by the higher, by the powerful to attack areas where, of course, we're going to have more civilian casualties because the military force there is part of the civil society.
That you know, what you just said is maybe the root of the problem, Frau Hughes, isn't it? That the military becoming part of civil society, the option that the U.S. has, diplomacy, is at the bottom in terms of a choice, yet the military and war is the seems to be the choice that the U.S. makes. Isn't that where the root of this problem is? Where, well, I mean, this, I mean, we could dream about it to have a world without wars. Why does the U.S. pursue the war path instead of the diplomatic path?
Thank you. Yes, I was just going to say it's maybe a case of might is right. America has the military and financial resources to be able to destroy a country like Iraq, to destroy a country like Afghanistan. It can destroy Syria if it so chooses. I think money is the root of all evil, and I think money is the root problem about taking the natural resources that belong to other people and other nations, other sovereign countries. I believe that during the American Civil War, Lincoln said he feared the bankers behind him more than he feared the Confederates in front of him. So war is about money. War is about profit. The modern day imperialist on the block is the United States of America. But we're just carrying on from the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century wars where we previously had colonization and occupation, military occupation, throughout the world by people like Britain, who at one stage occupied every country in the world bar 22, I think in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So it's about money, it's about profit, it's about the elite at the very top. I don't think the American people ever wanted the war in Iran. I don't think they wanted the war in Afghanistan. I think it is the corrupt political elite in the industrial military complex that are making profit, and they have the wherewithal to procure the weapons of war to make sure that they can win these battles against basically what are minnow countries with very little self-defense capabilities.
Thank you very much for that. We're unfortunately out of time. Let me thank Frau Hughes, journalist, author, and activist. And Judith Pillow. Judith Pillow, that website that you said, Ban Killer Drones, that's what the name is, .org, is that accurate?
Yes, it's bankillerdrones.org.
Okay, very good. Judith Pillow, peace and justice activist, and of course the website, Ban killerdrones.org. You do want to check it out. Spoke to us from Rochester, New York. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakati.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and he was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was brought up in the house of Nubuwwah, Prophethood, and Imamat, a house by which Allah had honored the Muslims all across the world. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam grew up in the shade of that honored and noble house, while he received high ideals, morals, values, knowledge, and wisdom from his father, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, who shed rays of light from his great soul unto Imam al-Jawad. Imam al-Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rida alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Rida alayhi salam took Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hand.